Today, I'm speaking with Bob Fisher. Bob is a senior research manager at Rethink Priorities, an associate professor at philosophy at Texas State University, and the director of the Society for the Study of Ethics and Animals.
Using neuron counts as a proxy for sentience.
A colleague of yours, I think at Rethink as well, has written this report on why neuron counts aren't actually a good proxy for what we care about here. Can you give kind of the quick summary of why they think that?
Sure. So there are two things to say. One is, it isn't totally crazy to use neuron counts. And one way of seeing why you might think it's not totally crazy is to think about the kinds of proxies that economists have used when trying to estimate human welfare. So economists have for a long time used income as a proxy for human welfare. And you might say, well, look, we know that there are all these ways in which that fails as a proxy. And the right response from the economist is something like, well, do you have anything better where there's actually data and where, you know, we can answer at least some of these high-level questions that we care about, or at least make progress on the high-level questions that we care about relative to baseline? And that way of thinking about what neuron count-based proxies are, I think, is the charitable interpretation. It's just like income in welfare economics. Imperfect, but maybe the best we can do in certain circumstances. That being said, the main problem is that there are lots of factors that really affect neuron count as a proxy that make it problematic. So one is just, you know, neuron counts alone are really sensitive to body size. So that's going to be a confounding factor. It seems like insofar as it tracks much of anything, it might be tracking something like intelligence. And it's not totally obvious why intelligence is morally important. At least in the human case, we often think that it's not important. And in fact, that it's like a really pernicious thing to make intelligence the metric by which we assess moral value. And then even if you think that neuron counts are, you know, proxies of some quality for something else, like the intensity of pain states or something, not clear that that's true. But even if that were true, you'd still have to ask, can we do any better? And it's not obvious that we can't do better. Not obvious that we can, but we should at least try.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. Are there any helpful thought experiments there? Like, it doesn't seem at all insane to me, though maybe you wouldn't expect it to kind of happen on its own through evolution, that there would be a being who has many fewer neurons than I do, but that those neurons are primarily directed at going from extreme pain to extreme kind of something like euphoria. And that just, it doesn't seem like there's a good reason that's not possible. And that extreme pain could just be much more than like the total amount of pain I could possibly feel, even though the types of pain might be different for me because I've got these kind of, I don't know, different kinds of capacities for sadness and shame and embarrassment, like a wider variety of types of pain. It still seems just like at least theoretically possible that you could house a bunch of pain in a small brain. And that feels like good reason to me to basically do what you've done, which is look for better ways than neurons alone.
Sure. And some evolutionary biologists have basically said things along these lines. Like Richard Dawkins actually has this line at some point where he says, oh, well, maybe simpler organisms actually need stronger pain signals because they don't learn as much as we do, and they don't remember all these facts. And so they need big alarm bells to keep them away from fitness-reducing threats. And so it's always possible that you have a complete inversion of the relationship that people imagine, and you want to make sure that your model captures that.
How to think about the moral weight of a chicken.
Just to make sure I understand, the thing is saying that the capacity of welfare or suffering of a chicken in a given instant is about a third of the capacity for the kind of pain and pleasure a human could experience in a given instant. Is that it?
That's the way to think about it. And that might sound very counterintuitive.
It does.
I understand that. And I think there are a couple things we can say to help get us in the right frame of mind for thinking about these results. So one is, think about it first like a biologist. If you think that humans' pain is orders of magnitude worse than the pain of a chicken, you got to point to some feature of human brains that's going to explain why that would be the case. And I think for a lot of folks, they have a kind of simple picture where they say more neurons equals more compute equals, you know, orders of magnitude difference in performance or something like that. And biologists are not going to think that way. They're going to say, well, look, you know, neurons produce certain functions and the number of neurons isn't necessarily that important to the function. And you might achieve the exact same function in using many more or many fewer neurons. And so that's just like not the really interesting, relevant thing. So that's the first step, is just to sort of try to think more like a biologist who's focused on functional capacities. So the second thing to say is just, you got to remember what hedonism says. So what's going on here is we're assuming that welfare is about just this one narrow thing, the intensities of pleasures and pains. You might not think that's true. You know, you might think welfare is about, you know, whether I know important facts about the world or whatever else, right? But that's not what I'm assessing, right? I'm just looking at this question of how intense is the pain. And you might also point out, quite rightly, but look, my cognitive life is richer. I have a more diverse range of negatively valent states. And I'm going to say, I don't care about the range. I care about the intensity, right? That's what hedonism says, is that what matters is how intense the pains are. So yeah, I'm very disappointed because, you know, choose unhappy event of your preference. My favorite team lost, you know, whatever the case may be, right?
Uh-huh.
And from the perspective of hedonism, what matters about that is just, well, how sad did it make me? Not the content of the experience, but just the amount of negatively valenced state that I'm experiencing, or rather the intensity of the negatively valenced state that I'm experiencing. So I think people often implicitly confuse variety in the range of valent states with intensity.
If these moral weights make you uncomfortable,
I think the thing that helps me to some degree is to say, you know, look, we're doing our best here under moral uncertainty. I think you should update in the direction of animals based on this kind of work if you've never taken animals particularly seriously before. But ethics is hard. There are lots of big questions to ask. I don't know if hedonism is true. I mean, there are good arguments for it. There are good arguments for all the assumptions that go into the project. But yeah, I'm uncertain at every step. And so some kind of higher level caution about the entire venture is appropriate. And if you look at the way people actually allocate their dollars, they often do spread their bets in precisely this way. Even if they're really in on animals, they're still giving some money to AMF, you know? And that makes sense because we want to make sure that we end up doing some good in the world. And that's a way of doing that.
Cool. Yeah, I guess I'm curious if there's anything you learned, or like a narrative or story that you have that makes this feel more plausible to you, like anything particular about chickens or just about philosophy. And you've already said some things, but what story do you have in your head that makes you feel comfortable being like, yes, I actually want to use these moral weights when deciding how to allocate resources?
So there are two things that I want to say about that. One is, I really worry about my own deep biases. And part of the reason that I'm willing to be part of the EA project is because I think that at its best, its attempt to say, yeah, my gut's wrong. I shouldn't trust it. I should take the math more seriously. I should try to put numbers on things and calculate. And when I'm uncomfortable with the results, I'm typically the problem and not the process that I used. So that's one thing. It's a check on my own tendency to discount animals, even as someone who spends most of their life working on animals, right? So I think that's one piece. The other thing is just to spend time thinking about the kinds of things animals can do and what their lives are like. You know, just how hard a chicken will work to get to a nest box before she lays an egg. The amount of labor she's willing to go through to do that, to think about how important that is to her and to realize that we can quantify that and see how much they care, or to see that they, you know, they get stressed out when fellow chickens are threatened and that they seem to have some sympathy, you know, for conspecifics. Those kinds of things make me say there is something in there that is recognizable to me as another individual with desires and preferences and a vantage point in the world who wants things to go a certain way and is frustrated and upset when they don't. And recognizing the individuality, the perspective of non-human animals, for me really challenges my tendency to not take them as seriously as I think I ought to, all things considered.
The moral weight of bees.
I was going to do something you probably wouldn't like, which is do the math and say something like, okay, that means that if, you know, I've got train tracks and I've got a human on one side, that means putting 14 bees on the other side. And obviously that's not taking into account the length of their lives. And so that actually isn't the kind of moral outcome you'd endorse, but like trading off an hour of suffering for both of those, for those two groups feels, I guess, even more uncomfortable to me. And it sounds like the thing you'd actually stand by is not this kind of like 1 to 14, 7% figure, but something like 1 to 100, a couple orders of magnitude. And even that, I think I'm still like 100 bees.
Yeah. So there are,
I like bees, but like,
sure.
Wow.
Totally. Right. So there are, I mean, again, a couple things to say. So one is, I do think size bias is real. Like, imagine if bees were the size of rhinos and you never had to worry about getting stung. You know, you'd probably be pretty into bees all of a sudden. You know, like, I think we are just affected by the fact that they're little and they feel very replaceable. We can't really observe their behaviors, et cetera, et cetera. So that's one thing to say.
On that, just because I think it might be interesting, are you imagining like a rhino-sized bee with a bee-sized brain?
Yep.
Interesting. Okay. So just kind of imagine a really big, fluffy bumblebee buzzing around, being adorable, not stinging you. Yeah, fair enough. I feel like I'd be like, that thing is cute and important and I got to protect it.
Got to protect that thing. Exactly. Oh, exactly.
Darn it, Bob.
So, you know, that, well, I know it's an uncomfortable fact about human psychology that we care about all the wrong things. But anyway, so that's one thing to say. Second thing to say is, again, the welfare range estimate is a factor here. The background commitment to something like utilitarianism or, you know, a welfarist consequentialism, that's doing a lot of the work. Like, we're just committed to aggregation if we're doing this kind of thing. And there's going to be some number of bees where you're supposed to flip the lever and kill the human. And that, again, might just make you uncomfortable. If it does, that's not my fault. Like, that's a function of the moral theory, not a function of the welfare range estimate. And the third thing to say is, I do think it's really important just to learn more about these animals. And, you know, and of course, they're, you know, bees in particular are very charismatic and cute. And go and watch Lars Chitka, who's a bee scientist, and he's got these lovely little videos of bees playing and rolling balls around, and it's adorable. And of course, you can feel lots of sympathy for bees if you watch those kinds of things. But for me, those actually are not the most interesting cases and compelling cases. For me, it's the fact that, like, when you look at Drosophila, fruit flies, you know, closely related to black soldier flies, you know, they're used as depression models for studying humans, as pain models. And you read all these papers, there are a million of them, and they will say, you know, it's amazing how similar the neurology of these organisms is to humans. They're such a perfect model, or such a useful model for understanding these aspects of the most excruciating and terrible human experiences. Isn't it great that what we can now do is, you know, starve them and put them, you know, through sleeplessness and all kinds of things. And guess what? They get depressed. And that's such a great way of studying these, you know, these horrible symptoms, some of the worst symptoms that humans ever experience. And so when you see that kind of thing in the literature and you see the excitement of researchers thinking about these organisms as ways of understanding humans and seeing the behavioral implications for these organisms, you start to think, man, there's something going on in that creature that should make me really uncomfortable.
Do octopuses have 9 minds?
There are actually a lot of animals where it isn't clear that they have the same kind of unified minds that we think of ourselves as having. Open question whether humans have the same kind of unified minds that we think of ourselves as having. But, you know, you don't have the same structures in birds, for instance, between the hemispheres. And you have this kind of distributed cognition, apparently, in octopuses. And you might think, well, does that mean that you don't just have one welfare subject in a chicken? Maybe you've got 2, one for each hemisphere. Or maybe you don't have one welfare subject, one entity of moral concern in an octopus. Maybe you've got 9. And of course, that would really change the moral weight that you assigned to that organism. So that's why we investigated. And then the upshot is, we basically don't think you should say that. and the short reason is that you want to think functionally about the mind. You want to think about what the overall organism is accomplishing with the ability that it has. And we should assume by default that these, you know, organisms evolve to be coordinated systems that are trying to accomplish the collective ends in the world. And I say collective as though we're thinking about the parts as separate individuals. But of course, that's exactly what's being contested. And the idea is, once we sort of think about things that way, it becomes a lot less plausible that there'd be an evolutionary reason for things to work in the way that it has these multiple minds. And we think the empirical evidence itself just isn't good enough to overcome that fundamental sort of default hypothesis.
Yeah, okay. Can you clarify why we think octopuses might have multiple minds? Is it just because they have neurons in their arms?
Yeah, so in the case of octopuses, part of it is just the concentration, the sheer number of neurons in the arms. Mm. Part of it is behavioral, where, you know, if you watch videos of octopuses, you can see examples of this, where it'll look like arms are kind of operating independently, sort of roving and exploring and reaching out on their own. And they don't seem to be coordinated with what's happening with sort of the main attention of the organism, and they're still off doing their own thing. And that gives people pause, and they start to think, oh, well, is it the case that all these neurons are acting in some semi-coordinated way independently of what's happening at the main site of cognition? And, you know, people have written some speculative pieces about this. Of course, it's very hard to test. Of course, many of the tests would be horrible. So, you know, like lots of reasons to think this is either, you know, a difficult question to answer or one that, insofar as we could answer it, perhaps we should not try. But it just looks like it'd be really hard to show that that was the case rather than some more modest hypothesis about the ability to sense more thoroughly through the appendage or whatever.
Right, right. And why is the theory that it's multiple minds rather than something like multitasking? Like, I feel like you could make a similar observation about me when I'm cooking and also having a conversation and also, I don't know, maybe that's the most I can do at once, but something like my hands are doing something while it seems like I'm like thoroughly mentally engaged in something else.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's easier as a case study to think about birds, where in humans, when you sever the corpus callosum, the thing that connects the two hemispheres, you do get these gaps where the hemispheres seem to operate in an uncoordinated way. And you have people report that they, you know, they don't know what the other hemisphere ostensibly seems to know, right? Based on the behavior that they're engaging in. And so if you don't have that structure in a bird, you might then wonder, oh, is what you have here effectively a split brain patient all the time, right? And then there are these interesting cases, like you think about dolphins, where they seem to have one hemisphere able to go into a sleep mode while the other hemisphere is awake. And seeing those kinds of things in other species can make you wonder whether there's just a very different organizational principle at work in those minds. And so if that's your sort of background context, then seeing this really distributed set of neurons in an octopus and then seeing the behavior that looks not entirely coordinated, et cetera, can motivate the idea of multiple minds. But it's, you know, admittedly, it's speculative stuff, really complicated set of questions. The work on that is in early days. So it's not like I think there's some super strong case that one might have had for that view.
What might you care about if you're risk averse?
If you're just comparing humans, chickens, and shrimp, and you're a straight expected value maximizer, well, of course, shrimp win because there are trillions of them. Mm-hmm. And so even given very small moral weights for shrimp, they just dominate. Now, suppose that you are worst case scenario risk averse. Well, now the case for shrimp looks even better, right, than it did before if you were a straight expected value maximizer. But then suppose you go in for one of those other two forms of risk aversion. You're worried about difference making or you don't really like ambiguity. Well, those penalize shrimp and maybe quite a lot to the point where the human causes look a lot better than the shrimp causes. The really interesting thing is that chickens actually look really good across the various types of risk aversion. So if you're a straight expected value maximizer, the shrimp beat the chickens. But once you've got one of those other kinds of risk aversion in play, you know, you're worried about difference making or ambiguity, that actually chickens look really good and they even beat the human causes. And the reason for that is really simple. It's just that there are so many chickens and we think they probably matter a fair amount.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so it's like, if you have some moderate amount of risk aversion, you might think intuitively that that's going to rule out the animal welfare interventions. And in fact, that's just not what happens. How sensitive are these results broadly? And maybe the best way to answer that question is just like, how close are chicken interventions to being beat out by one of these other two, such that is it possible that someone could just have slightly different beliefs to rethink and all of a sudden humans end up looking much better? Or would you have to have really different beliefs to rethink?
You'd have to have quite different views. So Laura Duffy did this wonderful report. She tries to answer this question by looking at different weights that you could have for chickens and seeing how robustly good chickens end up being, even if you think that they matter a lot less than the moral weight project suggests. And she found, yeah, you could think that they were an order of magnitude less important. So instead of 30% as important, 3% and still end up with this result that they look really good. So that's, you know, that's pretty striking.
What if you're not a hedonist?
Okay, so it sounds like we're both pretty sympathetic to hedonism. But let's say someone doesn't buy hedonism. Does that mean that the results of the Moral Weights Project in general aren't particularly relevant to how they decide how to spend their career and their money?
Yeah, so not at all, because any theory of welfare is going to give some weight to hedonic considerations. And so you're still going to learn something about what matters from this kind of project. And the question is just, how much of a welfare range do you think the hedonic portion is? Do you think it's a lot or do you think it's a little? And if you think it's a lot, then maybe you're learning a lot from this project. If you don't think that, okay, learning less. But insofar as you're sympathetic to hedonism, learning about the hedonic differences is going to matter for your cause prioritization.
Yeah. You have this thought experiment that you argue shows that non-hedonic goods and bads can't contribute that much to an individual's total welfare range, which you call, as for a shorthand, tortured Tim. Can you walk me through it? It's a bit complicated, but I think it's pretty interesting and worth doing.
Sure, sure. Well, the core idea is not that complicated. The way to think about it is, just imagine someone whose life is going as well as it can be in all the non-hedonic ways, right? They've got tons of friends. They've had lots of achievements. They know all sorts of important things, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they're being tortured. And they're being tortured to the point where they're in as much pain as they can be. And so now we can ask this question, okay, is that life, is that individual, are they well off on balance? Or is their life net negative, right? Is it on the whole bad in that moment? And if you say it's on the whole bad, then you're saying, hey, you could have all those great non-hedonic goods, all the knowledge and achievements and everything else, and they would not be enough to outweigh the intensity of that pain. And so that suggests that having all those non-hedonic goods isn't actually more important, isn't a larger portion of the welfare range than the hedonic portion. And that kind of caps how much good you can be in principle getting from all the non-hedonic stuff.
Yeah, I've never been tortured.
Good.
And part of me is like, yep, I buy that. I can't imagine being tortured and still feeling like my love of knowledge and learning and the fact that my family is out there and doing well and I've got friends who care about me. I can't really imagine having that outweigh the torture. On the other hand, like, is it insane to think that, like, there are people being tortured who would prefer not to die because they value life deeply inherently or the knowledge of their family and friends and kind of the world existing is worth existing for, despite immense pain? I mean, maybe it's just like, I'm just not thinking about enough pain. Maybe there is just like some extreme level of pain that, because I've never experienced torture, I will not at all be able to fully intuit this.
Sure. So there are a couple things to say. One is, as a direct response to your question, no, it's not crazy. I mean, you can certainly imagine people who do have that view. I've given a talk. I, you know, go to different universities and give talks about some of these issues. And I gave a talk about the tortured Tim case at one university. And a guy just said, oh, this couldn't be further from my view. It's just obvious to me that Tim's life is not just worth living, that it's one of the better lives.
Whoa.
Because of how all of these non-hedonic things that I had listed out. And, you know, in philosophy, we sometimes say, you know, there's the incredulous stare where you just sort of can't believe that someone has this view. And I confess, I did give him the incredulous stare. I feel guilty about it now. But, you know, that was his view. And so, all right, there are folks out there who think really differently about this. And the second thing to say is, you know, look, maybe there's a problem in the thought experiment. Like, maybe it turns out that you can't really have the objective goods when you're being tortured. And so it's not really, I mean, I don't really think that's that plausible, but you could imagine there being various philosophical moves that show that we're missing something here in the details. So maybe the takeaway is just, all right, look, you know, think about how valuable these non-hedonic goods are. Maybe you think they're much more valuable than I suggest in that thought experiment. But at least maybe it provides a bound. At least maybe it sort of challenges you to think that, at least given your views, the way you want to think about things, you shouldn't say that the non-hedonic goods are like 100x more important than the hedonic stuff. And as long as you don't say that, you're still getting some information from our project about just how important chickens are.
Yeah. When I try to make it really concrete and actually step away from the thought experiment and think about chickens. And I'm like, okay, it does seem like chickens probably have less capacity for the range of experiences that I have.
Totally.
They're not like getting to learn mind-blowing stuff about philosophy the way I am, which I feel very lucky to get to do. I am like, okay, but if in fact chickens, while being raised in factory farms, are regularly having their limbs broken, are sometimes starving. Yeah, as soon as I'm like, if that's anything like what that would be like for me, where like, you don't have to assume anything about whether there's also stuff about knowledge going on for chickens. It's just like, if their pain threshold is anything like my pain threshold, that alone is, yeah, I think basically getting me to the point where I'm like, yep, if I'm living in those conditions, it doesn't matter that much to me whether I also, in theory, have the capacity for like deep philosophical reasoning. And maybe that is like, you know, that's not the whole story here, but like that's what this is trying to, the intuition this is trying to push. Does that feel right to you?
Yeah. So I think something like that is correct. And I would just get there via a slightly different route and would say something like, think about the experience of dealing with children and what it's like to watch them be injured or to suffer. And it's intensely gripping and powerful, and they have very few capacities of the kind that we're describing. And yet that suffering seems extraordinarily morally important. And when I try to look past the species boundary and say, oh, look, you know, this is suffering and it's intense and it's acute, it's powerful. Does it seem like it matters? And it just seems, oh yeah, clearly it does. Clearly it does.